Possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos.
Enter the WILL sweepstakes today and you could win a widescreen, high-definition TV from Champaign Audio, a $1,000 gift certificate from Techline, an area rug from Sweeney Brothers Rug Gallery, or an AgriFab lawn vac. And if your entry is postmarked by August 19th, you'll be eligible to win the Early Bird Prize, $500 worth of colorful plants and shrubs for your garden from Country Arbors. If you need an entry form, give us a call at 217-333-0850. Don't wait. Send your entry in today.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The Hubble Space Telescope has now, over the last 14 years, provided us with a ever greater understanding of the universe. However, the future of the telescope now is in some doubt. If a mission to do some repairs and refurbishing isn't accomplished, astronomers say that sometime within the next couple of years, the Hubble will be nearing the end of its useful life. And there are a lot of people in the field of astronomy that think that would be too bad, that there's no reason that the instrument shouldn't continue to add to our knowledge about the universe, providing that it is maintained. We'll be talking a little bit about the Hubble, about more generally perhaps about space telescopes and the advantages that they present, and also about another instrument, the sort of the next generation space telescope. And we'll give people who are listening the opportunity to call in and ask questions. We have two guests with us this morning in this part of the show. Mario Livio is adjunct professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy of the Johns Hopkins University. He is also an astronomer at the Space Telescope Science Institute. John McCall is part of the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton University, where he is also professor of natural sciences. And both of them have been following the issues connected with Hubble for some time now. Questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening, if you'd like to be a part of the conversation. All you need to do is call us here in Champaign-Urbana. 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line. That means no matter where you're listening, if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number and calls on us. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, Professor Livio, hello.
Hi.
And Professor McCall.
Hello.
Thank you both very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
I certainly appreciate it. I want to ask some fairly basic questions about Hubble. One thing that I'm sure that people who are interested in astronomy will understand is the advantages that a space-based instrument gives you. However, people who don't might not really know the difference. We do indeed have and continue to use ground-based telescopes. But maybe you could talk a little bit, one or the other of you could talk a little bit about why it is that having the instrument in space above the atmosphere of the Earth gives you an edge over what you can do with a ground-based telescope.
Well, maybe I'll give you just an introduction to that. When we were working first to sell the space telescope, we used to say that the telescope would be placed out beyond where the stars twinkle. That indicates that the interference from the atmosphere of the Earth does not make the images blur. You see things much more clearly from space than you can from the ground. And in addition, you can see colors from space that you cannot see from the ground, because some of the colors of astronomical objects cannot penetrate the Earth's atmosphere.
Was that initially a difficult argument to make, that we should spend the money to put Hubble up there in the first place?
It initially looked like mission impossible. We got started with a small group of people mainly interested in space astronomy, but as time went on, the larger community of astronomers became convinced that this was a great thing to do for our entire science. However, the people at NASA were not so convinced. And in fact, the NASA administrator at the time, James Fletcher, went to President Nixon and told him that he needed a new shuttle orbiter, and the price that the Office of Management and Budget put upon the new orbiter was such that he would have to choose between either the orbiter or the space telescope. And he made that decision without consultation with any of the scientists in the program. He chose an extra orbiter, and he fought initially the efforts of the astronomers to lobby the Congress to overturn that decision.
Is that a reflection of what has been perhaps a continuing sort of tension between groups who are interested in different things? That is, between people who are interested in what you might argue would be pure science, that is, simply learning, trying to learn more about the universe and its history and how it's put together, and those people whose interest in space may be commercial, may be defense-oriented, both of those kinds of interests are competing for money. They have different sorts of constituencies. It seems that that kind of argument, if you want to use the term argument, has been going on for some time now, and maybe we expect that's never going to go away?
I don't think it's groups of people with particular interests. I think there are individuals with particular points of view, and I think people on all sides of the spectrum are in awe of what the Space Telescope has done and are very appreciative of the science and of the prestige that it's brought to our nation.
Can one of you talk a little bit about, obviously, there has been a lot of knowledge generated by Hubble, but maybe can you pick out one or two things that you think are particularly interesting or particularly important, things that we've learned because the Hubble is there that we didn't know before?
Sure. Let me give you a few examples. So one thing that we have known for a long time, in fact since the 1920s, was that our universe is expanding. It is not standing still. But what we have all assumed for a long time is that this expansion should be slowing down. In the same way that, you know, if I throw my keys up on Earth, they are slowing down because of the Earth gravity. We thought that under the gravity of all the mass within the universe, the expansion should be slowing down. Now, what we have found, not just by Hubble, but by a combination of Hubble and ground-based telescopes and other space telescopes, we have found just in the past few years, since 1998, is that this expansion is in fact speeding up. And we now know that this expansion is being pushed by some form of energy that, you know, for lack of a better name, we call dark energy, which is 73% of the energy of the universe, and which we don't have a clue at the moment what it is. I mean, you can imagine, the surface of the Earth is covered 70% with water. Imagine that we had no idea what water was. This is one of the things that Hubble has afforded us. Another thing is Hubble has given us the deepest view of the universe in the type of light that we can see with our eyes. Our universe is now about 13.7 billion years old. Hubble has given us a view in the combination of optical and heat light, infrared light, has given us a view of the universe when the universe was less than a billion years old. So it's like, you know, looking at, you take a person that's 70 years old and, you know, you look at it when it's just a small child. Hubble has given us the first atmosphere of a planet outside the solar system, the composition of that atmosphere. It has found that there is sodium there, there is hydrogen there is carbon and oxygen there, in a planet outside our solar system. And this is just, you know, a few examples from the many, many things that Hubble has done.
I'm sure that people will remember when Hubble was launched, there were some problems. with it that were then corrected by a mission that went up. We sent astronauts that went up and did some repairs. And from that point forward, it continued to perform very well and give us lots of useful information. People, I'm sure, though, will remember there were a lot of jokes made about Hubble and its problems initially. Can one of you talk about, and maybe again this would be John Bacall, talk a little bit about what caused the initial problems with Hubble?
Hubble's mirror was ground perfectly to the wrong prescription. It's like you had your glasses, but somebody else's prescription. So it didn't fit the telescope and the instruments that we had. What was necessary was to put an extra optical device inside the telescope or inside the instruments so that to correct the imperfect curvature of the mirror. Now the mirror is better than we had, with the correction, is better than we had anticipated before the telescope was launched.
Yeah, you're right about this business. You know that there have been initial jokes about this. It even featured in one of the Naked Gun movies, you know, as a disaster and so on. But what is more important is that through the ingenuity of scientists and engineers, and you know the work of the astronauts, I mean that initial error has been turned into one of the biggest successes of science ever. So, I mean, to some extent, even that initial error actually adds to the drama that, you know, has been surrounding this telescope. You take something that was supposed to be the biggest scientific failure and turn it into the biggest scientific success.
Hmm. Well, and many people think that the telescope is indeed the most successful large science project ever conducted.
What's been the price tag so far? What did it cost us to build Hubble and to put it up?
That depends on what items you include, but roughly $1 billion.
That was the initial cost, and of course, you know, if you start including from that, you know, what it has costed since then in terms of, you know, everything that has gone into it, it adds to a few billion dollars.
And how does that compare? I'm just curious about the cost of other things that we've done in space. For example, how much we've spent so far on the International Space Station?
Tiny. I think
spent much more on the. On the International Space Station.
I think the International Space Station was initially, there was an agreement that it would never exceed $8 billion. I think it's around, somewhere very crudely, around $40 billion. And if the current NASA plans are really carried out and it's completed, it may double that price. So space telescope is tiny compared to the International Space Station.
We have two guests with us this morning in the first hour focus, and probably I should introduce once again the two of them. Last person you heard is John Bacall from the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton University, where he's also professor of natural sciences. Also joining us is Mario Livio. He's adjunct professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy of the Johns Hopkins University. He's also astronomer at the Space Telescope Science Institute. And we're talking this morning a little bit about space telescopes. We've been talking here about the Hubble, and we'll also be talking about the next generation space telescope, the James Webb Space Telescope. Questions certainly are welcome if you'd like to call in. 333-9455, that's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. You're talking just a little bit earlier about the fact that there are many people who would consider the Hubble to be the most successful big science project ever, if not the most successful. I'm sure that people would consider it among the most successful. But now the future of the Hubble, there's some question about the future of the Hubble and whether it can be repaired and kept going at least for a few more years and generating more information. What exactly is the problem with the Hubble now, or what is it that if we're going to keep it going needs to be done?
Well, the Hubble uses gyroscopes, which it uses to point, and it also uses batteries that give it power. The gyroscopes, have a certain failure rate. Hubble can operate fully on three gyroscopes. There are now plans to make it operate even on two. But the problem is that if you look at the past and the rate at which gyroscopes, have become defunct, you find that sometime in the time frame of around 2007 or thereabouts, it will be down to one gyroscope, which will not allow it to continue its science program. Similarly, if you look at the batteries, those are going to run out also around the maybe 2008 or so time frame. So the point is that the telescope was built from the beginning to be serviced, and it has been serviced four times by shuttle astronauts. And in every one of these servicings, they both do maintenance work, like replacing bad gyroscopes and so on, and also they install new instruments, which make it essentially almost to be a new telescope. We currently have two such new instruments on the ground ready to be put up, and the maintenance work, that needs to be done. The problem has been that in January of this year, the NASA administrator made the announcement that because of the Columbia disaster, there will be no more visits by the shuttle to Hubble. Since then, many things have happened, including an important study by a committee chaired by John, a study by the National Academy of Sciences, and so on, and great support from the public. And the idea now is that the telescope may be serviced robotically, that is, not by the shuttle, not by human astronauts, but by a robotic mission that will perhaps do all of this. And this is currently under study.
Mm-hmm. Well, is the thinking that this robotic repair mission, and we're talking now, I think, about a robot that's built in Canada, do you think that that's actually up to the job? Because apparently the kind of tolerances and the precision that we're talking about to do these repairs are pretty tight.
Well, I think there are demonstrations that there are so far no showstoppers. That is to say, the things that have been tried seem to indicate that a robotic mission is possible in principle. But any new space mission, especially with an untested technology, is very risky. You never know whether it's going to work until you try it in space.
Well, Professor Olivia was just talking about the fact that there had all along the idea was that periodically that Hubble would repairs, maintenance would be done, and that would be a way of extending its life. And it had been done in the past by astronauts. But when the shuttle fleet was grounded after the Columbia disaster in February of last year, 2003, then after that, the NASA administrator said, well, we're not going to be able to do this anymore. And then in response to that, many people in the scientific community, astronomers and so forth, said, hey, wait a minute, this would be a real loss, so we ought to find some way to deal with this, and that's what we're talking about now. If the Columbia disaster hadn't occurred last year, would we be having the discussion that we're having now, or would we have had this discussion about should Hubble be allowed to die, or would we continue with this kind of periodic maintenance? And before the Columbia disaster, what were people thinking of in terms of the expected life
of
Hubble?
There was a planned servicing mission already. As I said, there are two ready instruments, and that servicing mission should have happened this coming year. And that would have done precisely what was needed in terms of both maintenance and putting in new instruments. In fact, one of the things that the committee that John chaired was looking at was even the possibility to have yet another servicing mission beyond that one to extend the life of the telescope even further. But there was no question about, you know, the existing servicing mission taking place and thereby extending the life of the telescope at least to the planned date, which was 2010.
So even at the beginning, nobody was thinking that Hubble would be there forever, but that it would have a useful life, and then at a certain point, it would be decommissioned, and then it would be allowed to come down.
That's right. One always needs to turn off even productive instruments in order to be able to afford the new generation of instruments and devices when you have a finite budget, as we do in science.
Well, if the kind of repairs that we've been talking about can be accomplished, now, assuming that that could be done, now what does that mean for the life expectancy of Hubble?
Well, you know, that, of course, that would not, if it were to be a robotic mission, that will not happen immediately because, of course, as John said, I mean, this has never been tried before. It will take a few years to prepare such a mission. But if that mission were to happen, let's say, in the 2007 or 8 time frame, then the idea was that that would extend the life of the telescope and, in fact, will continue with the telescope for another 5 years.
Is this is the question here, the primary questions about whether or not this repair mission can be mounted, are the primary questions here technical, that is, can we make it work, or is there still some question about money and how much it's going to cost and where that money will come from?
Well, the money is not fixed yet because the one thing that has been made clear by the years and years of experience with NASA development is that you can't predict how much a project will cost until you complete it, at least for the innovative new projects, and this is one such project. One could control the cost for a future shuttle mission, and in fact, a future shuttle mission was endorsed by 40 ex-astronauts who no longer work for NASA. I think the astronaut community have joined with the scientific community and, in fact, with school children throughout this country in saying we ought not to let Hubble die, and the astronauts are eager to service the telescope with a shuttle mission if allowed to do so.
Yeah, you must realize that it is not that the thought is not that astronauts will not fly at all. I mean, NASA still plans of order 25 missions to complete the space station with a shuttle. So, you know, what John was just saying is that many scientists, former astronauts, and the public in general said, well, you know, one extra mission to Hubble is definitely worth it.
And the difference in the safety between going to Hubble and going to the space station is a matter of debate. Admiral Gaiman and his person who chaired the committee about the Columbia disaster in his testimony before the National Academy Committee said that he had read interesting and convincing analyses on both sides of the question, which was it more dangerous to do, to go to the space station or to Hubble. But he said in any event, the difference was very small. It was measured in tenths of a percent.
Not necessarily
meaningful at that level. So it's clear that if you have two almost equivalent missions, if you send one to space station and one to Hubble, then it's much more dangerous to go 25 times to space station than once to Hubble.
And I guess we just one thing we do need to keep in mind is that going to space is dangerous. Full stop.
Yes.
That's and you know it's dangerous. Going to the space station is dangerous. Doing this is dangerous. Any time you go into space is dangerous. So the danger is pretty much equal.
I've talked to feel very strongly that if they're going into space and risking their lives, they'd like to do it for something that changes human history, like the Hubble Space Telescope.
We have a caller to talk with. Let us do that. Someone listening this morning in Indiana on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I must have my history confused, but my understanding was when Bush announced that he wanted to plant a man on Mars, that's when NASA said, well, that's the end of the shuttle program and forget about Hubble telescope repairs. Is that not true, or is have I been mistaken all along? Thank you.
There was a coincidence in time, but President Bush's initiative, which is almost identical to his father's initiative many years before, but which is not as well funded as his father's initiative was, his initiative was announced, and slightly before that, the decision had been taken that in order to reorient the agency and to save money and for various other reasons, none of which have ever been made crystal clear to the scientific community, the decision was made to not go to Hubble, but still to send 25 shuttle flights to the space station.
One of the things that that has been argued is that if we are indeed going to return to the moon and have some long-term human presence on the moon, or if we're going to think about something like going to Mars, that there's much more we need to learn and know about living in space for long periods of time. And that is one of the things the space station will do for us. I wonder, do you buy that argument? Is that true? And you know, how do you make the argument for spending as much money on the space station as it's going to cost?
Well, look, space station is primarily, I think, regarded as a technological achievement. I mean, it will be very difficult to argue that space station is scientifically a very important instrument. I mean, it is a technological achievement that you're able to be in space and work in space and build relatively complex structures in space. But at one point you have to decide that, if you like, to declare success or victory and that you have achieved that, and that is it. It is absolutely true that if humans were to go to Mars, you will need to overcome many, many problems associated with the exposure of humans to very, very long trips in space. And this, in fact, is going to be probably the biggest challenge to any such program. I mean, even more so, perhaps, than the technological challenge involved. Whether a space station is precisely the right way of doing that is, I think, unclear. And in any case, I mean, you know, we have currently robots on Mars, and they are doing an absolutely fabulous job, if you've seen the pictures that come from there. So, we could continue to do that for a long time.
Well, given the fact that that, again, say we're talking about going to Mars, we're talking about very large technical problems that need to be solved. And it's going to be very expensive if we decide that we're going to do that. And since there is only so much money going around, that means that if we decided to do that, maybe there were some other things that we would not do. What do you think generally about, and perhaps in a sense, Professor Levy, you've already answered this question, but about doing what it would take so that we could have a human being standing on the surface of Mars? And as far as science goes, is that something that's important to do?
I'd like to answer that as an American citizen and as a member of the human race. I think it's something that we would all be thrilled and enormously proud to have a human do. I think it's inspirational. I think the challenge to do that would invigorate our science and our technology, and it would provide a focus and a unity and a coherence for our space program. Whether it's going to be obtainable on the timescale that's been set, and whether this is the right time to do it, given the budgetary constraints that we have because of our many obligations internationally and within the country, that's another question. But I think all of us would be proud and thrilled if we could put a human presence on Mars.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here. We have another call we'll get right to. Let me again introduce our guests. John McCall is with the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton University. He's also a professor of natural sciences there. Mario Livio is adjunct professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy of the Johns Hopkins University. He is also astronomer at the Space Telescope Science Institute. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Bloomington, Indiana, another Indiana listener here, line number 4. Hello.
Hi, I have two questions. Do you know how time is allocated on the Hubble telescope? What astronomers get to use the Hubble, and how is it determined what they will study?
Okay, I can answer that. We have a very actually elaborate process of determining that. Every year...
initiated by my wife.
so we reveal any potential conflict of interest here.
Every year, there is a call for proposals for astronomers from all over the world. And they propose to use the telescope to solve very specific scientific problems. So they submit proposals in which they describe in great detail what scientific problem they want to study, how the telescope is going to be used to study that problem. They specify precisely what observations they need to do. And in particular, they have to demonstrate that the solution to this problem absolutely requires the use of the Hubble Space Telescope and that it cannot be used done, say, from the ground. Then the institute at which I am, the Space Telescope Science Institute, convenes of order 10 panels of experts in different subfields of astronomy. And these people study the different proposals. Typically, we get of order 1,000 to 1,200 proposals every year. So they study, first of all, in the different disciplines, these proposals, and rank them, literally rank them, you know, best to worst. Then we have a large time allocation committee, which is composed of experts from all the fields, and that time allocation committee looks at what was done in the different panels and also looks at large proposals that have been proposed and so on. And the net result of all of this is a ranked list of all the proposals. We then know exactly how much time is available for observation in every year, you know, given the efficiency of observations. So this, of course, marks a line as to which programs are going to be executed.
Oh, well, that's very interesting. I have one more question.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that the Hubble telescope has about a 90-minute orbit time around the Earth.
About 96, yes.
Okay. And for more than half of that time, the Hubble is in sunshine. Can the Hubble be used when it's exposed to sunshine? Is it any good?
Yeah, exposed to sunshine is not a problem. Of course, it cannot observe anything that's very near the sun. Hubble cannot observe the sun, or it cannot observe things like Mercury, which are too close to the sun. What is more important is that there is, for a part of the orbit, there is an Earth occultation, where the Earth, of course, occults parts of the sky. So that is the part that is lost in terms of observations.
I guess the reason that our telescopes are no good on Earth during daylight is because we have an atmosphere, and the atmosphere is reflecting light all over the place.
That's right.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. That's the one to use if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. We do also have the toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that astronomers always knew that Hubble would have a certain expected life and that a point would come when it would no longer be functional and it would come down. And that even if the repair mission that we discussed a little bit earlier, even if that happens, well, the same thing is true. With that, that's going to extend the life of Hubble for a few more years, but then again, it will come to the end of its life. One of the things that I wanted to make sure that we talked about was the what sometimes referred to as the next generation space telescope, the James Webb Space Telescope. And this was something that actually astronomers began planning for even before Hubble was launched. Back in 1989, I believe. Can one of you, or perhaps both of you, say something about this telescope and in what way or in what ways it's different from Hubble?
The James Webb Space Telescope is a very different telescope from Hubble. First of all, it observes primarily infrared or heat radiation, if you like. Hubble observes a little bit in the infrared, but mostly in the type of light that we see and in ultraviolet light. The James Webb will observe entirely in the infrared or heat radiation. It will be a much larger telescope. The Hubble is the main mirror is 2.4 meters or about 8 feet in diameter. The James Webb Space Telescope will be about 6.5 meters or 21 feet in diameter. Hubble is in an orbit, a very close orbit around Earth, which allows the shuttle to go to it and service it. The James Webb Space Telescope will be not serviceable, and it will be at a point which is about 1 million miles from Earth. So they are very, very different telescopes. The main focus of the James Webb Space Telescope is going to be the very distant universe. The point is that because the universe is expanding, the farther you look, light is actually shifted more and more into infrared. I mean, light is stretched out to infrared. And so if you want to observe the most distant universe, then you have to look in the infrared. So on one hand, this is the continuation in the sense that this is the next, you know, type of general-purpose space telescope. On the other, they are very, very different telescopes.
Sometimes we are asked, why do you astronomers need two space telescopes? And I think the answer can be made clear, certainly in this season, by saying that if you're going to play the game of trying to figure out what nature is like, you can't play the game with just a pitcher or just a catcher. You need both a pitcher and a catcher.
Oh, nice metaphor. So people should understand that this is not going to replace Hubble, and that when Hubble is gone, the kind of things that we've been able to do with that, we're simply not going to be able to do anymore. This will do something different, perhaps, add to our knowledge in different sorts of ways. But when Hubble is gone, that's gone, and that's the end of that kind of observation.
You're a very good student.
Yes.
does the fact that the Webb telescope is going to be out further and that there's no possibility of sending a mission to repair if there's some problem with it, does that make astronomers nervous at all that you got your one shot and if somehow something goes wrong or it goes wrong when it's out there, then there's no way to go and fix it?
Astronomers are always nervous, very nervous, when a new project gets started. And every time any one of these very complicated, very difficult frontier new developments of technology is placed in space, it's a miracle when it works. It's just that we've had repeated miracles.
Let's talk with another caller, someone I expect must be listening on the internet because they're calling from San Francisco. Line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, morning, all. I had two different questions. I understand the Hubble will be crashing to Earth at some time soon, so in this case it's not necessarily germane, but it has to do with salvaging the products that we, the taxpayers, have paid for. So I'm wondering, as privatization continues down here on Earth, we're essentially sending up a lot of very expensive items, in some cases, you know, radioactive isotopes, gold, massive amounts of gold, as I understand it, and some other minerals that are pretty expensive, and then the high tech that goes with it. And what is it, you know, in the case of the Hubble telescope, it almost seems like it was high dollar to begin with and then made obsolete through some flaws and then upgraded and then allowed to be destroyed through lack of budgeting. And I'm just wondering about this aspect of privatization that will allow some of our products to be salvaged at rock bottom cost by somebody else who we don't necessarily want to give it to. And I had a second question also, and this involves maybe something a little more insidious, and that's that you know, we've got a problem with. I'll let you start with that one.
Well, that's a difficult one. I don't think we know of anybody who has the technology to salvage the components of the Hubble Space Telescope. That's why this new mission is such a pioneering and challenging mission, to develop a robotic way to do that. And it will certainly cost much more than the salvage value of the components. After all, the technology for most of the telescope is technology that is more than two decades old.
Maybe I should mention that, the Hubble cannot just be left to fall by itself, because its mirror is going to survive, and the probability of it actually hitting something is more than the threshold allowed for such missions. And this is the reason that one of the things that the robotic mission will also do is attach a propulsion module to Hubble that will help actually direct it into the sea when the mission is over.
All right. So there really has to be some sort of an effort to reclaim it. The second question has a little more to do with theory, and you know, it's my understanding that string theory is not necessarily proven. Einstein's relativity tends to be the norm. And that in certain aspects with Hubble, it's being able to prove Einstein and somewhat disprove string theory. Now, in my understanding of Star Wars, a lot of the science of Star Wars is being proven to be a fraud. And so the very fact that Hubble is out there showing that Star Wars is a fraud is of a danger to the military-industrial complex, so that they would want to essentially allow this conflict of sciences to go on and allow their budgets to go on. If Hubble is shut down, then their pseudoscience can continue. And what I'm concerned with is whether or not they're defunding the program is going to allow bad science to continue, and as such, under the guise of top secrecy, they're going to be able to have all sorts of pseudoscience with fantastic budgets.
I don't think there's any connection in anybody's mind between the operational budget for the Hubble Space Telescope and programs to use missile defense.
No, I understand that. I'm just talking about being the Hubble is able to essentially prove or disprove string theory and relativity, right?
No. the predictions of string theory are not accessible to Hubble nor to any device that we know about, practical device that we know about today. So that has nothing to do with Hubble's operation or its achievements. I don't know if you have a GPS system in your car, but your car, if it locates your position, does depend upon an accurate use of Einstein's equations. So your car can be said to be proving Einstein's equations every day if you have a GPS system in it.
I'm going to jump in here just because we're coming down to about our last 5 minutes or so. And I am curious, again, to follow up, though, on one of the points the caller made about salvaging the possibility of salvaging some pieces of Hubble. I mean, is it the case that given the fact that it would be difficult and would be expensive and the fact that the technology now is a couple of decades old would just mean that there would be no point in doing that?
Well, at some point there was some discussion actually about the shuttle going up and trying to bring Hubble down intact to actually for it to be put in the Smithsonian, in the Air and Space Museum. However, this is not very easily achievable. Certainly, if shuttles are not going to fly to Hubble again, it's not going to happen. And in general, I mean, the feeling you get from astronauts, as John mentioned before, is that astronauts are willing to risk their lives.
Eager to risk their
lives. Yes, eager even to risk their lives for something that they see as, you know, the best scientific experiment of all time. They are really not that eager to risk their lives, for some sort of show type thing or to put Hubble out of its misery or things of that nature.
We talked, I did ask you a little bit earlier to talk about the James Webb Space Telescope, and I think Professor Livio did explain something of what it does and how it is different from Hubble. That is, it sees in a different way. Could you talk a little bit, or one or both of you, talk a little bit about some of the questions, some of the scientific questions that we might use the James Webb telescope to investigate? What sorts of things will it tell us by the way that it sees?
Well, in particular, it will actually show us the first generations of stars and galaxies in the universe. As I told you, with the Hubble, we can see to when the universe was less than a billion years old. But we already see that there are galaxies out there. They are smaller than today and more disturbed looking, but we see that they are there. With the James Webb, we will be able to look even farther back in time so that we will actually see probably the first generation of galaxies that have formed. We will literally see, you know, how things like the Milky Way in which we live have started from their infancy. How the first stars started to shine their light in the universe, and how they collected to form these, you know, island universes, which we call galaxies today.
This is one of these ideas that every time I say it amazes me, and yet I'm still not quite sure I understand it. But at least I understand it well enough to know that the further away that you're looking, the further away from the Earth that you're looking, you're also looking further back in time.
Absolutely. The telescopes are real-time machines.
My mind is, I guess, easily boggled. That's a concept that I'm afraid boggles mine.
Well, it's just the fact that the light takes a finite amount of time to get to us from where it's emitted. So if we receive it today, it was emitted earlier. If we receive it today from a source that's relatively nearby, like in our own galaxy, then it was emitted not too long ago. If it was emitted from a source which is as far away as we can see, then it was emitted billions and billions and billions of years ago.
Hmm. Right. The light that you see from the sun right now was emitted about 8 minutes ago. The light that was that you see from a galaxy that is a billion light years away was emitted about a billion light years ago.
So, assuming that we had the way to do it, how far back in time do you think it's possible to look? Or is it actually even possible to answer a question like that?
Well, it is in some ways. I mean, the universe was completely opaque to radiation when it was about 400,000 years old. And there was actually a satellite called WMAP that observed the radiation that comes from there. That is what we call the cosmic microwave background. You cannot see with light like, you know, the James Webb or Hubble is looking beyond that point. I mean, not even in principle. So in that sense, we're not going to see beyond that. Now, there are other ways to try to detect things that happened before that by the structure that formed and things like this. There will be other satellites like WMAP, in particular one called Planck, to be launched around 2007, that will look at even finer structures in the cosmic microwave background from which you may be able to tell even on things that happened when the universe was only a fraction of a second old, but again, indirectly.
Well, you know, we're come to the point where we're going to have to stop because we've used the time. I simply want to thank both of you for having talked with us this morning. Professor Livio, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
I'm Mario Livio. He's adjunct professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy of the Johns Hopkins University and an astronomer at the Space Telescope Science Institute, and also joining us from Princeton, John Bacall from the Institute for Advanced Study there. Professor Bacall, thank you very much.
It's always a thrill to talk about the Hubble telescope.
All right. Programming here on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. Today's programming is also made possible by a grant from the Living Yoga Center in downtown Champaign, offering a variety of classes designed to help students bring balance into their lives by finding strength and serenity through the practice of yoga. Classes are ongoing. Individuals may join any time. For more information, you can call 384-5829 or visit their website at www.livingyogacenter.net. Coming up a little bit later today, as part of the Afternoon Magazine, the host of the Midnight Special will be stopping by. Rich Warren will be talking about music and sharing some of the music that has captured his attention recently, and they'll also be taking your phone calls. That comes after the 1 o'clock news. Celeste Quinn is the host for the program. The show begins at noon with news from NPR, the BBC, and AM 580. Also, meteorologist Scott Althoff will have weather at 12:35. That's all part of the Afternoon Magazine here on AM 580, starting at noon. In the next part of this show, we'll be talking with one of the men that took part in the battle that was dramatized by the book and the film Black Hawk Down. His name is Dan Schilling, and he's contributed to a collection of first-hand accounts from a man who fought in that battle. It's been published in book form titled The Battle of Mogadishu, and he'll be talking with us in the next part of the show. First, though, we'll take a break for news and update on the markets.
And with this